Chapter 12. World has ever known, have waited upon the signs of his westerly sky. Fleets of victorious ships have hung upon his breath. He has tossed in his hand squadrons of war-scarred three-deckers, and shredded out in mere sport the bunting of flags hallowed in the traditions of honor and glory. He is a good friend and a dangerous enemy, without mercy to unseaworthy ships and faint-hearted seamen. In his kingly way he has taken but little account of lives sacrificed to his impulsive policy. He is a king with a double-edged sword bared in his right hand. The east wind, an interloper in the dominions of westerly weather, is an impassive-faced tyrant with a sharp poniard held behind his back for a treacherous stab. In his forays into the North Atlantic, the east wind behaves like a subtle and cruel adventurer without a notion of honor or fair play. Veiling his clear-cut, lean face in a thin layer of a hard, high cloud, I have seen him, like a wizened robber sheik of the sea, hold up large caravans of ships to the number of 300 or more at the very gates of the English Channel. And the worst of it was that there was no ransom that we could pay to satisfy his avidity, for whatever evil is wrought by the raiding east wind, it is done only to spite his kingly brother of the west. We gazed helplessly at the systematic, cold, gray-eyed obstinacy of the easterly weather, while short rations became the order of the day, and the pinch of hunger under the breastbone grew familiar to every sailor in that held-up fleet. Every day added to our numbers. In knots and groups and straggling parties we flung to and fro before the closed gate. And meantime the outward-bound ships passed, running through our humiliated ranks under all the canvas they could show. It is my idea that the easterly wind helps the ships away from home in the wicked hope that they shall all come to an untimely end, and be heard of no more. For 6 weeks did the robber sheik hold the trade route of the earth, while our liege lord, the west wind, slept profoundly like a tired titan, or else remained lost in a mood of idle sadness known only to frank natures. All was still to the westward. We looked in vain towards his stronghold. The king slumbered on so deeply that he let his foraging brother steal the very mantle of gold-lined purple clouds from his bowed shoulders. What had become of the dazzling hoard of royal jewels exhibited at every close of day? Gone, disappeared, extinguished, carried off without leaving a single gold band, or the flash of a single sunbeam in the evening sky. Day after day through a cold streak of heavens as bare and poor as the inside of a rifled safe a rayless, and despoiled sun would slink shamefacedly, without pomp or show, to hide in haste under the waters. And still the king slept on, or mourned the vanity of his might and his power, while the thin-lipped intruder put the impress of his cold and implacable spirit upon the sky and sea. With every daybreak the rising sun had to wade through a crimson stream, luminous and sinister, like the spilt blood of celestial bodies murdered during the night. In this particular instance the mean interloper held the road for some 6 weeks on end, establishing his particular administrative methods over the best part of the North Atlantic. It looked as if the easterly weather had come to stay forever, or, at least, till we had all starved to death in the held-up fleet, starved within sight, as it were, of plenty, within touch, almost, of the bountiful heart of the empire. There we were, dotting with our white dry sails the hard blueness of the deep sea. There we were, a growing company of ships, each with her burden of grain, of timber, of wool, of hides, and even of oranges, for we had one or two belated fruit schooners in company. There we were, in that memorable spring of a certain year in the late 70s, dodging to and fro, baffled on every tack, and with our stores running down to sweepings of bread lockers and scrapings of sugar casks. It was just like the east wind's nature to inflict starvation upon the bodies of unoffending sailors, while he corrupted their simple souls by an exasperation leading to outbursts of profanity as lurid as his blood-red sunrises. They were followed by gray days under the cover of high, motionless clouds that looked as if carved in a slab of ash-colored marble. And each mean-starved sunset left us calling with imprecations upon the west wind even in its most veiled misty mood to wake up, and give us our liberty, if only to rush on and dash the heads of our ships against the very walls of our unapproachable home. XXIX. In the atmosphere of the easterly weather, as pellucid as a piece of crystal and refracting like a prism, we could see the appalling numbers of our helpless company, even to those who in more normal conditions would have remained invisible, sails down under the horizon. It is the malicious pleasure of the east wind to augment the power of your eyesight, in order, perhaps, that you should see better the perfect humiliation, the hopeless character of your captivity. Easterly weather is generally clear, and that is all that can be said for it, almost supernaturally clear when it likes. But whatever its mood, there is something uncanny in its nature. Its duplicity is such that it will deceive a scientific instrument. No barometer will give warning of an easterly gale, were it ever so wet. It would be an unjust and ungrateful thing to say that a barometer is a stupid contrivance. It is simply that the wiles of the east wind are too much for its fundamental honesty. After years and years of experience, the most trusty instrument of the sort that ever went to sea screwed onto a ship's cabin bulkhead will, almost invariably, be induced to rise by the diabolic ingenuity of the easterly weather, just at the moment when the easterly weather, discarding its methods of hard, dry, impassive cruelty, contemplates drowning what is left of your spirit in torrents of a peculiarly cold and horrid rain. The sleet and hail squalls following the lightning at the end of a westerly gale are cold, and venoming and stinging and cruel enough. But the dry easterly weather, when it turns to wet, seems to rain poison showers upon your head. It is a sort of steady, persistent, overwhelming, endlessly driving downpour, which makes your heart sick, and opens it to dismal forebodings. And the stormy mood of the easterly weather looms black upon the sky with a peculiar and amazing blackness. The west wind hangs heavy gray curtains of mist and spray before your gaze, but the eastern interloper of the narrow seas, when he has mustered his courage and cruelty to the point of a gale, puts your eyes out, puts them out completely, makes you feel blind for life upon a lee shore. It is the wind, also, that brings snow. Out of his black and merciless heart he flings a white blinding sheet upon the ships of the sea. He has more manners of villainy, and no more conscience than an Italian prince of the 17th century. His weapon is a dagger carried under a black cloak when he goes out on his unlawful enterprises. The mere hint of his approach fills with dread every craft that swims the sea, from fishing smacks to foremasted ships that recognize the sway of the west wind. Even in his most accommodating mood he inspires a dread of treachery. I have heard upwards of 80 of windlasses spring like one in two clanking life in the dead of night, filling the downs with a panic-struck sound of anchors being torn hurriedly out of the ground at the first breath of his approach. Fortunately, his heart often fails him. He does not always blow home upon our exposed coast. He has not the fearless temper of his westerly brother. The natures of those two winds that share the dominions of the great oceans are fundamentally different. It is strange that the winds which men are prone to style capricious remain true to their character in all the various regions of the earth. To us here, for instance, the east wind comes across a great continent, sweeping over the greatest body of solid land upon this earth. For the Australian east coast, the east wind is the wind of the ocean, coming across the greatest body of water upon the globe, and yet here and there its characteristics remain the same with a strange consistency in everything that is vile and base. The members of the West Wind's dynasty are modified in a way by the regions they rule, as a Hohenzollern, without ceasing to be himself, becomes a Romanian by virtue of his throne, or a Saxe Coburg learns to put the dress of Bulgarian phrases upon his particular thoughts, whatever they are. The autocratic sway of the West Wind, whether 40 north or 40 south of the equator, is characterized by an open, generous, frank, barbarous recklessness. for he is a great autocrat, and to be a great autocrat you must be a great barbarian. I have been too much molded to his sway to nurse now any idea of rebellion in my heart. Moreover, what is a rebellion within the four walls of a room against the tempestuous rule of the west wind? I remain faithful to the memory of the mighty king with a double-edged sword in one hand, and in the other holding out rewards of great daily runs, and famously quick passages to those of his courtiers who knew how to wait watchfully for every sign of his secret mood. As we deep water men always reckoned, he made 1 year in 3 fairly lively for anybody having business upon the Atlantic, or down there along the ordies of the Southern Ocean. You had to take the bitter with the sweet, and it cannot be denied he played carelessly with our lives and fortunes. But then, he was always a great king, fit to rule over the great waters where, strictly speaking, a man would have no business whatever, but for his audacity. The audacious should not complain. A mere traitor ought not to grumble at the tolls levied by a mighty king. His mightiness was sometimes very overwhelming. But even when you had to defy him openly, as on the banks of the Agulhas homeward bound from the East Indies, or on the outward passage round the Horn, he struck at you fairly his stinging blows full in the face too, and it was your business not to get too much staggered. And, after all, if you showed anything of a countenance, the good-natured barbarian would let you fight your way past the very steps of his throne. It was only now and then that the sword descended and a head fell, but if you fell you were sure of impressive obsequies, and of a roomy, generous grave. Such is the king to whom Viking chieftains bowed their heads, and whom the modern and palatial steamship defies with impunity 7 times a week. And yet it is but defiance, not victory. The magnificent barbarian sits enthroned in a mantle of gold-lined clouds looking from on high on great ships gliding like mechanical toys upon his sea, and on men who, armed with fire and iron, no longer need to watch anxiously for the slightest sign of his royal mood. He is disregarded, but he has kept all his strength, all his splendor, and a great part of his power. Time itself, that shakes all the thrones, is on the side of that king. The sword in his hand remains as sharp as ever upon both its edges, and he may well go on playing his royal game of quoits with hurricanes, tossing them over from the continent of republics to the continent of kingdoms, in the assurance that both the new republics and the old kingdoms, the heat of fire and the strength of iron, with the untold generations of audacious men, shall crumble to dust at the steps of his throne, and pass away, and be forgotten before his own rule comes to an end. XXX. The estuaries of rivers appeal strongly to an adventurous imagination. This appeal is not always a charm, for there are estuaries of a particularly dispiriting ugliness. Lowlands, mud flats, or perhaps barren sandhills without beauty of form or amenity of aspect, covered with a shabby and scanty vegetation conveying the impression of poverty and uselessness. Sometimes such an ugliness is merely a repulsive mask. A river whose estuary resembles a breach in a sand rampart may flow through a most fertile country. But all the estuaries of great rivers have their fascination, the attractiveness of an open portal. Water is friendly to man. The ocean, a part of nature furthest removed in the unchangeableness and majesty of its might from the spirit of mankind, has ever been a friend to the enterprising nations of the earth. And of all the elements this is the one to which men have always been prone to trust themselves, as if its immensity held a reward as vast as itself. From the offing the open estuary promises every possible fruition to adventurous hopes. That road open to enterprise and courage invites the explorer of coasts to new efforts towards the fulfillment of great expectations. The commander of the first Roman galley must have looked with an intense absorption upon the estuary of the Thames as he turned the beaked prow of his ship to the westward under the brow of the north for land. The estuary of the Thames is not beautiful, It has no noble features, no romantic grandeur of aspect, no smiling geniality, but it is wide open, spacious, inviting, hospitable at the first glance, with a strange air of mysteriousness which lingers about it to this very day. The navigation of his craft must have engrossed all the Romans' attention in the calm of a summer's day. He would choose his weather, when the single row of long sweeps the galley would be a light one, not a trireme, could fall in easy cadence upon a sheet of water like plate glass, reflecting faithfully the classic form of his vessel, and the contour of the lonely shores close on his left hand. I assume he followed the land, and passed through what is at present known as Margate Roads, groping his careful way along the hidden sandbanks, whose every tail and spit has its beacon or buoy nowadays. He must have been anxious, though no doubt he had collected beforehand on the shores of the Gauls a store of information from the talk of traders, adventurers, fishermen, slave dealers, pirates, all sorts of unofficial men connected with the sea in a more or less reputable way. He would have heard of channels and sandbanks, of natural features of the land useful for sea marks, of villages and tribes and modes of barter, and precautions to take. With the instructive tales about native chiefs dyed more or less blue, whose character for greediness, ferocity, or amiability must have been expounded to him with that capacity for vivid language which seems joined naturally to the shadiness of moral character and recklessness of disposition. With that sort of spiced food provided for his anxious thought, watchful for strange men, strange beasts, strange turns of the tide, he would make the best of his way up, a military seaman with a short sword on thigh, and a bronze helmet on his head, the pioneer post-captain of an imperial fleet. Was the tribe inhabiting the Isle of Thanet of a ferocious disposition, I wonder, and ready to fall with stone-studded clubs, and wooden lances hardened in the fire, upon the backs of unwary mariners? Amongst the great commercial streams of these islands, the Thames is the only one, I think, open to romantic feeling, from the fact that the sight of human labor and the sounds of human industry do not come down its shores to the very sea, destroying the suggestion of mysterious vastness caused by the configuration of the shore. The broad inlet of the shallow North Sea passes gradually into the contracted shape of the river. But for a long time the feeling of the open water remains with the ship steering to the westward through one of the lighted and buoyed passageways of the Thames, such as Queen's Channel, Prince's Channel, Four Fathom Channel, or else coming down the Swin from the north. The rush of the yellow flood tide hurries her up, as if into the unknown between the two fading lines of the coast. There are no features to this land, no conspicuous, far-famed landmarks for the eye. There is nothing so far down to tell you of the greatest agglomeration of mankind on earth dwelling no more than 25 miles away, where the sun sets in a blaze of color flaming on a gold background, and the dark, low shores trend towards each other. And in the great silence the deep, faint booming of the big guns, being tested at Sheberiness, hangs about the Norre historical spot in the keeping of one of England's appointed guardians. XXXI. The Norre sand remains covered at low water, and never seen by human eye, but the Norre is a name, to conjure with visions of historical events, of battles, of fleets, of mutinies, of watch and ward kept upon the great throbbing heart of the state. This ideal point of the estuary, this center of memories, is marked upon the steely gray expanse of the waters by a lightship painted red that, from a couple of miles off, looks like a cheap and bizarre little toy. I. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.